the hands of untrustworthy men, that, being once assembled, its deliberations could not be confined to any specific acts. Finally, Lincoln stood up and walked over to Stanton's desk, where he wrote what would be the final telegram issued under his name from the War Department. He directed General Weitzel to withdraw the original permission for the legislature to convene. "Do not now allow them to assemble, but if any have come, allow them safe return to their homes." Stanton was pleased, believing that was exactly right. On Thursday, April 13th, Grant journeyed to Washington, where Stanton had planned a celebration in his honor. "As we reached our destination that bright morning in our boat," Julia Grant recalled, "every gun in and near Washington burst forth, and such a salvo! All the bells rang out merry greetings, and the city was literally swathed in flags and bunting." Grant went to see the president, while Julia at the Willard Hotel received calls of congratulations all day. Later in the afternoon, she and Ellen Stanton joined their husbands at the War Department. There, Julia recalled, "Stanton was in his happiest mood, showing me many stands of arms, flags, and, among other things, a stump of a large tree perforated on all sides by bullets taken from the field of Shiloh. He enthusiastically detailed plans for the illumination of his department that night, and facetiously remarked, 'They are going to illuminate at the Navy Department, I know, for they sent and borrowed two or three boxes of candles from my department.'" For the first time since Willie's death, Mary Lincoln seemed positively carefree. She had received a delightful note from her husband the day before, only a few lines, but playfully and tenderly worded, notifying the hour of the day he would drive with me. She wrote a number of letters, all brimming with vitality. "We are rejoicing beyond expression over our great and glorious victories," she told James Bennett. To her friend Abram Wakeman, she described in detail the charming time she had enjoyed at City Point. "I wish very much you had been with us. Even our stately, dignified Mr. Sumner acknowledged himself transformed into a lad of 16. She told Sumner that her new volume of Julius Caesar had arrived, and she invited him to join her that evening at the White House for a visit with General Grant. Good Friday, April 14th, 1865, was surely one of Lincoln's happiest days. The morning began with a leisurely breakfast in the company of his son Robert, just arrived in Washington. "Well, my son, you have returned safely from the front," Lincoln said. "The war is now closed, and we soon will live in peace with the brave men that have been fighting against us." He urged Robert to lay aside his army uniform and finish his education, perhaps in preparation for a law career. As the father imparted his advice, Elizabeth Keckley observed, his face was more cheerful than she had seen it for a long while. At 11 a.m., Grant arrived at the White House to attend the regularly scheduled Friday cabinet meeting. He had hoped for word that Johnston's army, the last substantial rebel force remaining, had surrendered to Sherman, but no news had yet arrived. Lincoln told Grant not to worry. He predicted that the tidings would come soon, for he had, last night, the usual dream which he had preceding nearly every great and important event of the war. Wells asked him to describe the dream. Turning toward him, Lincoln said it involved the Navy Secretary's element, the water, that he seemed to be in some singular, indescribable vessel, and that he was moving with great rapidity towards an indefinite shore, that he had this dream preceding Sumter, Bull Run, Antietam, Gettysburg, Stone River, Vicksburg, Wilmington, etc. Grant remarked that not all those great events had been victories, but Lincoln remained hopeful that this time this event would be favorable. The complexities of reestablishing law and order in the southern states dominated the conversation. A few days earlier, Stanton had drafted a plan for imposing a temporary military government on Virginia and North Carolina until the restoration of civilian rule. Lincoln alluded to the paper, Stanton later recalled, went into his room, brought it out, and asked me to read it. A general discussion revealed that most of the cabinet concurred, although Wells and Dennison objected to the idea of undoing state boundaries by uniting two different states into a single military department. Recognizing the validity of this objection, Lincoln asked Stanton to revise his plan to make it applicable to two separate states. Lincoln said that he thought it providential that this great rebellion was crushed just as Congress had adjourned, since he and the cabinet were more likely to accomplish more without them than with them regarding Reconstruction. He noted that there were men in Congress who, if their motives were good, were nevertheless impracticable, and who possessed feelings of hate and vindictiveness in which he did not sympathize and could not participate. He hoped there would be no persecution, no bloody work, after the war was over. As for the rebel leaders, Lincoln reiterated his resolve to perpetrate no further violence. None need expect he would take any part in hanging or killing those men, even the worst of them. While their continued presence on American soil might prove troublesome, he preferred to frighten them out of the country, open the gates, let down the bars, scare them off. To illustrate his point, he shook his hands as if scaring sheep and said, "Enough lives have been sacrificed. We must extinguish our resentments if we expect harmony and union." After the cabinet meeting, Stanton and Speed descended the stairs together. "Didn't our chief look grand today?" Stanton asked. Years later, Speed held fast to the memory of Lincoln's personal appearance that day, with cleanly shaved face, well-brushed clothing, and neatly combed hair and whiskers, a marked contrast to his usual rumpled aspect. Stanton later wrote that Lincoln seemed more cheerful and happy than at any previous cabinet meeting, thrilled by the near prospect of firm and durable peace at home and abroad. Throughout the discussion, Stanton recalled, Lincoln spoke very kindly of General Lee and others of the Confederacy, exhibiting in marked degree the kindness and humanity of his disposition and the tender and forgiving spirit that so eminently distinguished him. Later that day, Lincoln put into practice his liberal policy toward the rebel leaders. Intelligence had reached Stanton at the War Department that a conspicuous secessionist, Jacob Thompson, was en route to Portland, Maine, where a steamer awaited to take him to England. Operating from Canada, Thompson had organized a series of troublesome raids across the border that left Stanton with little sympathy for the Confederate marauder. Upon reading the telegram, Stanton did not hesitate a moment. "Arrest him," he ordered Assistant Secretary Dana. As Dana was leaving the room, however, Stanton called him back. "No, wait. Better to go over and see the President." Dana found Lincoln in his office. "Hello, Dana," Lincoln greeted him. "What's up?" Dana described the situation, explaining that Stanton wanted to arrest Thompson, but thought he should first refer the question to Lincoln. "Well," said Lincoln, "no, I rather think not. When you have got an elephant by the hind leg, and he's trying to run away, it's best to let him run." Mary Lincoln's memories of her husband's infectious happiness that day match the recollections of his inner circle. She had never seen him so cheerful, she told Francis Carpenter. His manner was even playful. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he drove out with me in the open carriage. In starting, I asked him if anyone should accompany us. He immediately replied, "No, I prefer to ride by ourselves today." During the drive, he was so gay that I said to him laughingly, "Dear husband, you almost startle me by your great cheerfulness." He replied, "And well I may feel so, Mary. I consider this day the war has come to a close." And then added, "We must both be more cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of our darling Willie, we have both been very miserable." As the carriage rolled toward the Navy Yard, Mary recalled, he spoke of his old Springfield home, and recollections of his early days, his little brown cottage, the law office, the courtroom, the green bag for his briefs and law papers, his adventures when riding the circuit. They had traveled an unimaginable distance together since their first dance in Springfield, a quarter of a century earlier. Over the years, they had supported each other, irritated each other, shared a love of family, politics, poetry, and drama. Mary's descent into depression after Willie's death had added immeasurably to Lincoln's burdens, and the terrible pressures of the war had further distorted their relationship. His intense focus on his presidential responsibilities had often left her feeling abandoned and resentful. Now, with the war coming to an end, and time bringing solace to their grief, the Lincolns could plan for a happier future. They hoped to travel some day, to Europe and the Holy Land, over the Rockies to California, then back home to Illinois, where their life together had begun. As the carriage neared the White House, Lincoln saw that a group of old friends, including Illinois Governor Richard Oglesby, were just leaving. "Come back, boys, come back," he told them, relishing the relaxing company of friends. They remained for some time, Governor Oglesby recalled. Lincoln got to reading some humorous book. I think it was by John Phoenix. They kept sending for him to come to dinner. He promised each time to go, but would continue reading the book. Finally, he got a sort of peremptory order that he must come to dinner at once. The early dinner was necessary, for the Lincolns had plans to see Laura Keene in Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater that evening. After supper, the president met with Noah Brooks, Massachusetts Congressman George Ashman, and Speaker Colfax, who was soon to depart for California. "How I would rejoice to make that trip," Lincoln told Colfax, "but public duties chain me down here, and I can only envy you its pleasures." The president invited Colfax to join him at the theater that night, but Colfax had too many commitments. To Noah Brooks, Lincoln had never seemed more hopeful and buoyant concerning the condition of the country. He was full of fun and anecdotes, feeling especially jubilant at the prospect before us. His parting words, Brooks recalled, focused on the country's economic future. "Grant thinks that we can reduce the cost of the army establishment at least $500,000 a day, which, with the reduction of expenditures of the Navy, will soon bring down our national debt to something like decent proportions, and bring our national paper up to a par, or nearly so, with gold." Speaker Colfax was among several people who declined the Lincolns' invitation to the theater that evening. The morning edition of the National Republican had announced that the Grants would join the Lincolns in the president's box that night, but Julia Grant had her heart set on visiting their children in New Jersey, so Grant asked to be excused. The Stantons also declined. Stanton, like Chase, considered the theater a foolish diversion, and, more important, a dangerous one. He had fought a losing battle for months to keep the president from such public places, and he felt that his presence would only sanction an unnecessary hazard. Earlier that day, Unwilling to encourage the theater project, Stanton had refused to let his chief telegrapher, Thomas Eckert, accept Lincoln's invitation, even though the president had teasingly requested him for his uncommon strength. He had been known to break a poker over his arm and could serve as a bodyguard. It was after 8 when the Lincolns entered their carriage to drive to the theater. "I suppose it's time to go," Lincoln told Colfax, "though I would rather stay." While nothing had provided greater diversion during the bitter nights of his presidency than the theater, Lincoln required no escape on this happy night. Still, he had made a commitment. "It has been advertised that we will be there," he told his bodyguard, Crook, who had the night off, "and I cannot disappoint the people." Clara Harris, the daughter of Mary's friend, Senator Ira Harris, and her fiancé, Major Henry Rathbone, joined the Lincolns in their carriage. As the Lincolns rode to Ford's Theater on 10th Street, John Wilkes Booth and 3 conspirators were a block away at the Herndon House. Booth had devised a plan that called for the simultaneous assassinations of President Lincoln, Secretary of State Seward, and Vice President Johnson. Having learned that morning of Lincoln's plan to attend the theater, he had decided that this night would provide their best opportunity. The powerfully built Lewis Powell, accompanied by David Herold, was assigned to kill Seward at his Lafayette Square home. Meanwhile, the carriage maker, George Atzerodt, was to shoot the vice president in his suite at the Kirkwood Hotel. Booth, whose familiarity with the stagehands would ensure access, would assassinate the president. Just as Brutus had been honored for slaying the tyrant Julius Caesar, Booth believed he would be exalted for killing an even greater tyrant. Assassinating Lincoln would not be enough. Booth knew, his biographer observes, that in the end, the Brutus conspiracy was foiled by Mark Antony, whose famous oration made outlaws of the assassins and a martyr of Caesar. William Henry Seward, Lincoln's Mark Antony, must not live. Finally, to throw the entire North into disarray, the vice president must die as well. The triple assassinations were set for 10:15 p.m. Still bedridden, Seward had enjoyed his best day since his nearly fatal carriage accident 9 days earlier. Fanny Seward noted in her diary that he had slept well the previous night and had taken solid food for the first time. In the afternoon, he had listened with a look of pleasure to the narrative of the events of the cabinet meeting, which Fred, as assistant secretary, had attended in his father's stead. Later in the afternoon, he had listened to Fanny's reading of Enoch Arden, and remarked on how much he enjoyed it. The 3-story house was full of people. The entire family, except Will and Jenny, were there. Francis, Augustus, Fred, Anna, and Fanny. In addition to the 6 household servants and the State Department messenger rooming on the 3rd floor, 2 soldiers had been assigned by Stanton to stay with Seward. In the early evening, Edwin Stanton had stopped by to check on his friend and colleague. He stayed for a while, chatting with other visitors, until martial music in the air reminded him that War Department employees had planned on serenading him that night at his home, 6 blocks away. After all the guests left, the quiet arrangements for the night began. To ensure that Seward was never left alone, the family members had taken turns sitting by his bed. That night, Fanny was scheduled to stay with him until 11 p.m., when her brother Gus would relieve her. George Robinson, one of the soldiers whom Stanton had detailed to the household, was standing by. Shortly after 10 p.m., Fanny noticed that her father was falling asleep. She closed the pages of The Legends of Charlemagne, turned down the gas lamps, and took a seat on the opposite side of the bed. Fred Seward later wrote that there seemed nothing unusual in the occurrence when a tall, well-dressed but unknown man presented himself at the door. Powell told the servant, who had answered the bell, that he had some medicine for Mr. Seward, and had been instructed by his physicians to deliver it in person. "I told him he could not go up," the servant later testified, "that if he would give me the medicine, I would tell Mr. Seward how to take it." Powell was so insistent that the boy stepped aside. When he reached the landing, Fred Seward stopped him. "My father is asleep. Give me the medicine and the directions. I will take them to him." Powell argued that he must deliver it in person, but Fred refused. At this point, Fred recalled, the intruder stood apparently irresolute. He began to head down the stairs, then, suddenly turning again, he sprang up and forward, having drawn a navy revolver, which he leveled with a muttered oath at my head, and pulled the trigger. This was the last memory Fred would have of that night. The pistol misfired, but Powell brought it down so savagely that Fred's skull was crushed in two places, exposing his brain and rendering him unconscious. Hearing the disturbance, Private Robinson ran to the door from Seward's bedside. The moment the door was opened, Powell rushed inside, brandishing his now broken pistol in one hand and a large knife in the other. He slashed Robinson in the forehead with his knife, knocking him partially down, and headed towards Seward. Fanny ran beside Powell, begging him not to kill her father. When Seward heard the word "kill," he awakened, affording him one glimpse of the assassin's face bending over before the large Bowie knife plunged into his neck and face, severing his cheek so badly that the flap hung loose on his neck. Oddly, he would later recall that his only impressions were what a fine-looking man Powell was, and what handsome cloth that overcoat is made of. Fanny's screams brought her brother Gus into the room as Powell advanced again upon Seward, who had been knocked to the floor by the force of the blows. Gus and the injured Robinson managed to pull Powell away, but not before he struck Robinson again and slashed Gus on the forehead and the right hand. When Gus ran for his pistol, Powell bolted down the stairs, stabbing Emmerich Hansel, the young State Department messenger, in the back, before he bolted out the door and fled through the city streets. The clamor had roused the entire household. Anna sent the servant to fetch Dr. Verdi, while Private Robinson, though bleeding from his head and shoulders, lifted Seward onto the bed and instructed Fanny about staunching the blood with clothes and water. Still fearing that another assassin might be hiding in the house, Francis and Anna checked the attic, while Fanny searched the rooms on the parlor floor. Dr. Verdi would never forget his first sight of Seward that night. He looked like an exsanguinated corpse. In approaching him, my feet went deep in blood. Blood was streaming from an extensive gash in his swollen cheek. The cheek was now laid open. So frightful was the wound, and so great was the loss of blood, that Verdi assumed the jugular vein must have been cut. Miraculously, it was not. Further examination revealed that the knife had been deflected by the metal contraption holding Seward's broken jaw in place. In bizarre fashion, the carriage accident had saved his life. "I had hardly sponged his face from the bloody stains and replaced the flap," Verdi recalled, "when Mrs. Seward, with an intense look, called me to her. 'Come and see Frederick,' said she." Not understanding, he followed Francis to the next room, where he found Frederick bleeding profusely from the head. Fred's appearance was so ghastly, and his wounds so large, that Verdi feared he would not live, but with the application of cold water pledgets, he was able to stanch the bleeding temporarily. Once Fred was stabilized, Francis drew Dr. Verdi into another room on the same floor. "For heaven's sake, Mrs. Seward," asked the befuddled doctor. "What does all this mean?" Verdi found Gus lying on the bed with stab wounds on his hand and forehead, but assured Francis that he would recover. Francis barely had time to absorb these words of comfort before entreating Dr. Verdi to see Private Robinson. "I ceased wondering," Verdi recalled. "My mind became as if paralyzed. Mechanically, I followed her and examined Mr. Robinson. He had 4 or 5 cuts on his shoulders." "Any more?" Verdi asked, though not imagining the carnage could go on. "Yes," Francis answered. "One more." She led him to Mr. Hansel, piteously groaning on the bed. Stripping off the young man's clothes, Verdi found a deep gash just above the small of the back, near the spine. "And all this," Verdi thought, "the work of one man." "Yes, of one man." In preparing for the attack on the vice president, George Atzerodt had taken a room at the Kirkwood Hotel, where Johnson was staying. At 10:15, he was supposed to ring the bell of Suite 68, enter the room by force, find his target, and murder him. When first informed that the original plan to kidnap the president had shifted to a triple assassination, he had balked. "I won't do it," he had insisted. "I enlisted to abduct the President of the United States, not to kill." He had eventually agreed to help, but 15 minutes before the appointed moment, seated at the bar of the Kirkwood House, he changed his mind, left the hotel, and never returned. John Wilkes Booth had left little to chance in his plot to kill the president. Though already well acquainted with the layout of Ford's Theater, Booth had attended a dress rehearsal the day before to better rehearse his scheme for shooting Lincoln in the state box and then escaping into the alley beside the theater. That morning, he had again visited the theater to collect his mail, chatting amiably in the front lobby with the theater owner's brother, Harry Ford. Booth had already taken his place inside the theater when the Lincolns arrived. The play had started as the presidential party entered the flag-draped box in the dress circle. The notes of "Hail to the Chief" brought the audience to their feet, applauding wildly and craning to see the president. Lincoln responded with a smile and bow before taking his seat in a comfortable armchair at the center of the box, with Mary by his side. Clara Harris was seated at the opposite end of the box, while Henry Rathbone occupied a small sofa on her left. Observing the president and first lady, one theater-goer noticed that she rested her hand on his knee much of the time and often called his attention to some humorous situation on the stage. Mary herself later recalled that, as she snuggled ever closer to her husband, she had whispered, "What will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?" He had looked at her and smiled. "She won't think anything about it." During the performance, the White House footman delivered a message to the president. At about 10:12, the impeccably dressed John Wilkes Booth presented his calling card to the footman and gained admittance to the box. Once inside, he raised his pistol, pointed it at the back of the president's head, and fired. As Lincoln slumped forward, Henry Rathbone attempted to grab the intruder. Booth pulled out his knife, slashed Rathbone in the chest, and managed to leap from the box onto the stage 15 feet below. As he jumped, one eyewitness recalled, one of the spurs on his riding boots caught in the folds of the flag draped over the front and caused him to fall partly on his hands and knees as he struck the stage. Another onlooker observed that he was suffering great pain, but making a desperate effort, he struggled up. Raising his shining dagger in the air, which reflected the light as though it had been a diamond, he shouted the now historic words of the Virginia state motto, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants, and ran from the stage. until the screams broke forth from the president's box. Many in the audience thought the dramatic moment was part of the play. Then they saw Mary Lincoln frantically waving. "They have shot the president," she cried. "They have shot the president." Charles Leal, a young doctor seated near the presidential box, was the first to respond. "When I reached the president," he recalled, "he was almost dead. His eyes were closed." Unable at first to locate the wound, he stripped away Lincoln's coat and collar. Examining the base of the skull, he discovered the perfectly smooth opening made by the ball. Using his finger as a probe to remove the coagula, which was firmly matted with the hair, he released the flow of blood, relieving somewhat the pressure on Lincoln's brain. Another doctor, Charles Sabin Taft, Julia Taft's half-brother, soon arrived, and the decision was made to remove the president from the crowded box to a room in the Peterson boarding house across the street. By this time, people had massed in the street. The word began to spread that assassins had attacked not only Lincoln, but Seward as well. Joseph Sterling, a young clerk in the War Department, rushed to inform Stanton of the calamity. On his way, he encountered his roommate, J.G. Johnson, who joined him on the terrible errand. "When Johnson and I reached Stanton's residence," Sterling recalled, "I was breathless. So when Stanton's son, Edwin Jr., opened the door, Johnson was the one to speak. 'We have come," Johnson said, "to tell your father that President Lincoln has been shot." Young Stanton hurried to his father, who had been undressing for bed. When the war secretary came to the door, Sterling recalled, "he fairly shouted at me in his heavy tones, 'Mr. Sterling, what news is this you bring?'" Sterling told him that both Lincoln and Seward had been assassinated. Desperately hoping this news was mere rumor, Stanton remained calm and skeptical. "Oh, that can't be so," he said. "That can't be so." But when another clerk arrived at the door to describe the attack on Seward, Stanton had his carriage brought around at once, and, against the appeals of his wife, who feared that he too might be a target, he headed for Seward's house at Lafayette Square. The news reached Gideon Wells almost simultaneously. He had already gone to bed when his wife reported someone at the door. "I arose at once," Wells recorded in his diary, "and raised a window, when my messenger, James, called to me that Mr. Lincoln, the president, had been shot, and that Seward and his son had been assassinated." Wells thought the story very incoherent and improbable, but the messenger assured him that he had already been to Seward's house to check its veracity before coming to see his boss. Also ignoring his wife's protests, Wells dressed and set forth in the foggy night for the Seward house on the other side of the square. Upon reaching Seward's house, Wells and Stanton were shocked at what they found. Blood was everywhere. On the white woodwork of the entry, on the stairs, on the dresses of the women, on the floor of the bedroom. Seward's bed, Wells recalled, was saturated with blood. The secretary was lying on his back, the upper part of his head covered by a cloth which extended down over his eyes. Wells questioned Dr. Verdi in a whisper, but Stanton was unable to mute his stentorian voice until the doctor asked for quiet. After looking in on Fred's unconscious form, the two men walked together down the stairs. In the lower hall, they exchanged what information they had regarding the president. Wells thought they should go to the White House, but Stanton believed Lincoln was still at the theater. Army Quartermaster General Meigs, who had just come to the door, implored them not to go to 10th Street, where thousands of people had gathered. When they insisted, he decided to join them. 12 blocks away, in his home at 6th and E Streets, Chief Justice Chase had already retired for the night. Earlier that afternoon, he had taken a carriage ride with Nettie, intending to stop at the White House to remonstrate with Lincoln over his too lenient approach to Reconstruction and his failure to demand universal suffrage. At the last minute, uncertain how Lincoln would take it, Chase had decided to wait until the following day. He was fast asleep when the servant knocked on his bedroom door. There was a gentleman downstairs, the servant said, who claimed the president had been shot. The caller was a Treasury employee who had actually witnessed the shooting by a man who leaped from the box upon the stage and escaped by the rear. Chase hoped he might be mistaken, but in short order three more callers arrived. Each confirmed what I had been told and added that Secretary Seward had also been assassinated and that guards were being placed around the houses of all the prominent officials under the apprehension that the plot had a wide range. My first impulse was to rise immediately and go to the president, but reflecting that I could not possibly be of any service and should probably be in the way of those who could, I resolved to wait for morning and further intelligence. In a little while the guard came, for it was supposed that I was one of the destined victims, and their heavy tramp-tramp was heard under my window all night. It was a night of horrors. When Stanton and Wells arrived at the crammed room in the Peterson boarding house, they found that Lincoln had been placed diagonally across a bed to accommodate his long frame. Stripped of his shirt, his large arms, Wells noted, were of a size which one would scarce have expected from his spare appearance. His devastating wound, the doctors reported with awe, would have killed most men instantly, or in a very few minutes. But Mr. Lincoln had so much vitality that he continued to struggle against the inevitable end. Mary spent most of the endless night weeping in an adjoining parlor, where several women friends tried vainly to comfort her. About once an hour, Wells noted, she would repair to the bedside of her dying husband, and with lamentation and tears remain until overcome by emotion. She could only rotely repeat the question, "Why didn't he shoot me? Why didn't he shoot me?" Though everyone in the room knew the president was dying, Mary was not told, out of fear that she would collapse. Whenever she came into the room, Dr. Taft recalled, clean napkins were laid over the crimson stains on the pillow. Early on, Mary sent a messenger for Robert, who had remained at home that night in the company of John Hay. He had already turned in when the White House doorkeeper came to his room. "Something happened to the president," Thomas Pendle told Robert. "You had better go down to the theater and see what it is." Robert asked Pendle to get Hay. Reaching Hay's room, Pendle told him, "Captain Lincoln wants to see you at once. The president has been shot." Pendle recalled that when Hay heard the news, he turned deathly pale, the color entirely leaving his cheeks. The two young men jumped in a carriage, picking up Senator Sumner along the way. Mary was torn over whether to summon Tad, but was apparently persuaded that the emotional boy would be devastated if he saw his father's condition. Tad and his tutor had gone that night to Grover's Theater to see Aladdin. The theater had been decorated with patriotic emblems, and a poem commemorating Fort Sumter's recapture was read aloud between the acts. An eyewitness recalled that the audience was enjoying the spectacle of Aladdin when the theater manager came forward as pale as a ghost. A look of mortal agony contorted his face as he announced to the stunned audience that the president had been shot at Ford's Theater. In the midst of the pandemonium that followed, Tad was seen running like a young deer, shrieking in agony. "Poor little Tad," Pendle recalled, returned to the White House in tears. "Oh, Tom Penn, Tom Penn," Tad wailed. "They have killed Papa dead. They've killed Papa dead." Pendle carried the little boy into Lincoln's bedroom. Turning down the bed covers, he helped Tad undress and finally got him to lie down. I covered him up and lay down beside him, put my arm around him, and talked to him until he fell into a sound sleep. By midnight, The entire cabinet, with the exception of Seward, had gathered in the small room at the Peterson boarding house. An eyewitness noted that Robert Lincoln bore himself with great firmness and constantly endeavored to assuage the grief of his mother by telling her to put her trust in God. Despite his brave attempts to console others, he was sometimes entirely overcome and would retire into the hall and give vent to most heart-rending lamentations. Almost no one was able to contain his grief that night, for, as one witness observed, there was not a soul present that did not love the president. To Edwin Stanton fell the onerous task of alerting the generals, taking the testimony of witnesses at the theater, and orchestrating the search for the assassins. While evidently swayed by the great shock which held us all under its paralyzing influence, Colonel A.F. Rockwell noted, he was not only master of himself, but unmistakably the dominating power over all. Indeed, the members of the cabinet, much as children might to their father, instinctively deferred to him in all things. Throughout the night, Stanton dictated numerous dispatches, which were carried to the War Department telegraph office by a relay team of messengers positioned nearby. Each messenger, Stanton's secretary recalled, after handing a dispatch to the next, would run back to his post to wait for the next. The first telegram went to General Grant, requesting his immediate presence in Washington. The president was assassinated at Ford's Theater at 10:30 tonight and cannot live. Secretary Seward and his son Frederick were also assassinated at their residence and are in a dangerous condition. The dispatch reached Grant in the Bloodgood Hotel, where he was taking supper. He dropped his head, Horace Porter recalled, and sat in perfect silence. Noticing that he had turned very pale, Julia Grant guessed that bad news had arrived and asked him to read the telegram aloud. First, prepare yourself for the most painful and startling news that could be received, he warned. As he made plans to return to Washington, he told Julia that the tidings filled him with the gloomiest apprehension. The president was inclined to be kind and magnanimous, and his death at this time is an irreparable loss to the South, which now needs so much both his tenderness and magnanimity. At 1 a.m., Stanton telegraphed the chief of police in New York, telling him to send here immediately 3 or 4 of your best detectives. Half an hour later, he notified General Dix, "The wound is mortal. The president has been insensible ever since it was inflicted and is now dying." 3 hours later, he updated Dix, "The president continues insensible and is sinking." Early eyewitness accounts, Stanton revealed, suggested that 2 assassins were engaged in the horrible crime, Wilkes Booth being the one that shot the president. Shortly after dawn, Mary entered the room for the last time. The death struggle had begun, Wells recorded. As she entered the chamber and saw how the beloved features were distorted, she fell, fainting, to the floor. Restoratives were given, and Mary was assisted back to the sofa in the parlor, never again to see her husband alive. No sooner had the town clocks struck 7, one observer recalled, than the character of the president's breathing changed. It became faint and low. At intervals it altogether ceased, until we thought him dead. And then it would be again resumed. Lincoln's 9-hour struggle had reached its final moments. "Let us pray," Reverend Phineas D. Gurley said, and everyone present knelt. At 7:22 a.m., April 15, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was pronounced dead. Stanton's concise tribute from his deathbed still echoes. Now he belongs to the ages. When Mary was told that he was gone, she piteously demanded, "Oh, why did you not tell me that he was dying?" Her moans could be heard throughout the house. Finally, with Robert's help, she was taken to her carriage, which had waited in front of the house through the long night. Until the moment of Lincoln's death, Stanton's coolness and self-possession had seemed remarkable to those around him. Now he could not stop the tears that streamed down his cheeks. In the days that followed, even as he worked tirelessly to secure the city and catch the conspirators, Stanton's grief was uncontrollable, recalled Horace Porter, and at the mention of Mr. Lincoln's name, he would break down and weep bitterly. While Stanton's raw grief surprised those who had seen only his gruff exterior, John Hay understood. "Not everyone knows, as I do," he wrote Stanton, "how close you stood to our lost leader, how he loved you and trusted you, and how vain were all the efforts to shake that trust and confidence, not lightly given and never withdrawn. All this will be known sometime, of course, to his honor and yours." Salmon Chase was up at dawn. Soldiers had guarded him through the night of horrors, and he was ready to join his colleagues at Lincoln's side. As he reached 10th Street, however, he encountered Assistant Treasury Secretary Mansell Field. "Is he dead?" Chase asked. "Yes," Field replied, noting that Chase's eyes were bloodshot and his entire face was distorted. The Chief Justice had arrived too late. The President was already dead, and his colleagues had dispersed. Uncertain what to do next, Chase walked to Seward's house. Guards had been stationed to prevent entry, but Chase was recognized and allowed into the lower hall. There, doctors told him that Seward had partially recovered and, though still in critical condition, might live, but that Mr. Frederick Seward's case was hopeless. Chase headed toward the Kirkwood Hotel to call on the man who represented the future, the soon-to-be president, Andrew Johnson. In Johnson's suite, he encountered his old enemies, Montgomery Blair and his father. He took old man Blair's hand and, with tearful eyes, said, "Mr. Blair, I hope that from this day there will cease all anger and bitterness between us." The old gentleman responded with equal warmth and kindness. Perhaps more than any of Lincoln's colleagues, the southern-born Blairs understood that the assassination was a calamity for the South. Those of southern sympathies know now they have lost a friend, willing and more powerful to protect and serve them than they can now ever hope to find again, Elizabeth Blair remarked to her husband in a letter later that day. Their grief is as honest as that of anyone of our side. An editorial in the Richmond Whig expressed similar sentiments, observing that with Lincoln's death, the heaviest blow which has ever fallen upon the people of the South has descended. In distant St. Louis, where his son Barton had found him a new house with a large garden and a comfortable study, Edward Bates was shaken by the astounding news that reached him by telegram. In his diary, he remarked that beyond the calamity which the nation has sustained, my private feelings are deeply moved by the sudden murder of my chief, with and under whom I have served the country through many difficult and trying scenes, and always with mutual sentiments of respect and friendship. I mourn his fall, both for the country and for myself. News of Lincoln's death was withheld from Seward. The doctors feared that he could not sustain the shock. On Easter Sunday, however, as he looked out the window toward Lafayette Park, he noticed the War Department flag at half-mast. He gazed a while, Noah Brooks reported. Then, turning to his attendant, he announced, "The President is dead." The attendant tried to deny it, but Seward knew with grim certainty. "If he had been alive, he would have been the first to call on me," he said. "But he has not been here, nor has he sent to know how I am. And there's the flag at half-mast." He lay back on the bed, the great tears coursing down his gashed cheeks, and the dreadful truth sinking into his mind. His good friend, his captain and chief, was dead. The history of governments, John Hay later observed, affords few instances of an official connection hallowed by a friendship so absolute and sincere as that which existed between these two magnanimous spirits. Lincoln had snatched away from Seward at Chicago the prize of a laborious lifetime when it seemed within his grasp, yet Seward was the first man named in his cabinet, and the first who acknowledged his personal preeminence. From the beginning of the administration to that dark and terrible hour when they were both struck down by the hand of murderous treason, there was no shadow of jealousy or doubt ever disturbed their mutual confidence and regard. Flags remained at half-mast in the nation's capital until the last week of May, when citizens from all over the country came to Washington to witness the farewell march of nearly 200,000 Union soldiers who would soon disband and return to their homes. Stanton had orchestrated the two-day pageant as a final tribute to the brave men who had fought on battlefields from Antietam to Fredericksburg, Gettysburg to Vicksburg, Atlanta to the sea. "Never in the history of Washington," reported Noah Brooks, "had there been such an enormous influx of visitors as at that time. For weeks there had been so vast a volume of applications for accommodations at the hotels and boarding houses that every available nook and corner had been taken." Schools and government buildings were closed for the occasion. Reviewing stands had been built all along Pennsylvania Avenue, from the Capitol to the White House. A covered platform had been erected to seat President Andrew Johnson, General Grant, and an assortment of dignitaries. The weather was beautiful on both days. The air was bright, clear, and invigorating. The first day was dedicated to the Army of the Potomac. Hour after hour the troops filed past in review. The cavalry, the mounted artillery, the infantry, the engineering brigades, each with their distinctive uniforms and badges, accompanied by the clatter of hoofs, the clank of sabers, and the shrill call of bugles. It was, Gideon Wells marveled, a magnificent and imposing spectacle. "You see, in these armies," Stanton predicted, "the foundation of our republic, our future railway managers, congressmen, bank presidents, senators, manufacturers, judges, governors, and diplomats. Yes, and not less than half a dozen presidents." He was very nearly right, for five of the next seven presidents would be Civil War veterans: Ulysses S. Grant, Rutherford B. Hayes, James Garfield, Benjamin Harrison, and William McKinley. Over a quarter of a century earlier, in 1838, young Abraham Lincoln had spoken with fervor of the veterans of the Revolutionary War, who were by then mostly gone, the fabled scenes of their great struggle for American independence growing more and more dim by the lapse of time. In that war, Nearly every adult male had been a participant, he said, in the form of a husband, a father, a son, or a brother, until a living history was to be found in every family. Such, he had said, was no longer true for his generation. Now, a new living history had been forged in the families of nearly 3 million Union soldiers who had fought to create what their matured leader had called a new birth of freedom, to ensure that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. The soldiers marching down Pennsylvania Avenue that warm spring day knew they had accomplished something that would change their lives and their nation forever. The second day belonged to the Army of the West, marching with solemn dignity behind General Sherman. The streets were filled with people to see the pageant, Sherman recalled. When I reached the Treasury Building and looked back, the sight was simply magnificent. The column was compact, and the glittering muskets looked like a solid mass of steel, moving with the regularity of a pendulum. When Sherman came to the corner of Lafayette Square, someone pointed to an upper window of a brick house where Seward, still too feeble to walk on his own, had been carried to witness the parade. "I moved in that direction and took off my hat to Mr. Seward," Sherman recalled. He recognized the salute, returned it, and then we rode on steadily past the president, saluting with our swords. All of Washington was present, Gideon Wells sadly noted. Congressmen, senators, justices, diplomats, governors, military officers, the members of the cabinet, fathers and sons, mothers and daughters. But Abraham Lincoln was not there. All felt this. None felt that absence more keenly than the members of his cabinet, the remarkable group of rivals whom Lincoln had brought into his official family. They had fiercely opposed one another, and often contested their chief on important questions. But, as Seward later remarked, a cabinet which should agree at once on every such question would be no better or safer than one counselor. By calling these men to his side, Lincoln had afforded them an opportunity to exercise their talents to the fullest, and to share in the labor and the glory of the struggle that would reunite and transform their country and secure their own places in posterity. "I have no doubt that Lincoln will be the conspicuous figure of the war," predicted Ulysses S. Grant. "He was incontestably the greatest man I ever knew." The poet Walt Whitman felt much the same. "I have more than once fancied to myself," Whitman wrote in 1888, "the time when the present century has closed, and a new one opened, and the men and deeds of that contest have become somewhat vague and mythical." He fancied that at some commemoration of those earlier days, an ancient soldier would sit surrounded by a group of young men whose eyes and eager questions would betray their sense of wonder. "What, have you seen Abraham Lincoln, and heard him speak, and touched his hand?" Though conceding that the future might decide differently about the Prairie President, Whitman had no trouble speaking for his own generation. "Abraham Lincoln seems to me the grandest figure yet on all the crowded canvas of the 19th century." Even Whitman might have been amazed by the scope of Lincoln's legacy by the time the new century arrived. In 1908, in a wild and remote area of the North Caucasus, Leo Tolstoy, the greatest writer of the age, was the guest of a tribal chief living far away from civilized life in the mountains. Gathering his family and neighbors, the chief asked Tolstoy to tell stories about the famous men of history. Tolstoy told how he entertained the eager crowd for hours with tales of Alexander, Caesar, Frederick the Great, and Napoleon. When he was winding to a close, the chief stood and said, "But you have not told us a syllable about the greatest general and greatest ruler of the world. We want to know something about him. He was a hero. He spoke with a voice of thunder. He laughed like the sunrise, and his deeds were strong as the rock. His name was Lincoln, and the country in which he lived is called America, which is so far away that if a youth should journey to reach it, he would be an old man when he arrived. Tell us of that man." I looked at them, Tolstoy recalled, and saw their faces all aglow, while their eyes were burning. I saw that these rude barbarians were really interested in a man whose name and deeds had already become a legend. He told them everything he knew about Lincoln's home life and youth, his habits, his influence upon the people, and his physical strength. When he finished, they were so grateful for the story that they presented him with a wonderful Arabian horse. The next morning, as Tolstoy prepared to leave, they asked if he could possibly acquire for them a picture of Lincoln. Thinking that he might find one at a friend's house in the neighboring town, Tolstoy asked one of the riders to accompany him. "I was successful in getting a large photograph from my friend," recalled Tolstoy. As he handed it to the rider, he noted that the man's hand trembled as he took it. He gazed for several minutes, silently, like one in a reverent prayer, his eyes filled with tears. Tolstoy went on to observe, "This little incident proves how largely the name of Lincoln is worshipped throughout the world, and how legendary his personality has become. Now, why was Lincoln so great that he overshadows all other national heroes? He really was not a great general, like Napoleon or Washington. He was not such a skillful statesman as Gladstone or Frederick the Great. But his supremacy expresses itself altogether in his peculiar moral power and in the greatness of his character. Washington was a typical American. Napoleon was a typical Frenchman. But Lincoln was a humanitarian as broad as the world. He was bigger than his country, bigger than all the presidents together." "We are still too near to his greatness," Tolstoy concluded, "but after a few centuries more, our posterity will find him considerably bigger than we do. His genius is still too strong and too powerful for the common understanding. Just as the sun is too hot when its light beams directly on us." Every man is said to have his peculiar ambition, the 23-year-old Abraham Lincoln had written in his open letter to the people of Sangamon County during his first bid for public office in the Illinois State Legislature. "Whether it be true or not, I can say, for one, that I have no other ambition so great as that of being truly esteemed of my fellow men, by rendering myself worthy of their esteem. How far I shall succeed in gratifying this ambition is yet to be developed." The ambition to establish a reputation worthy of the esteem of his fellows, so that his story could be told after his death, had carried Lincoln through his bleak childhood, his laborious efforts to educate himself, his string of political failures, and a depression so profound that he declared himself more than willing to die, except that he had done nothing to make any human being remember that he had lived. An indomitable sense of purpose had sustained him throughout the disintegration of the Union and through the darkest months of the war, when he was called upon again and again to rally his disheartened countrymen, soothe the animosity of his generals, and mediate among members of his often contentious administration. His conviction that we are one nation, indivisible, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal, led to the rebirth of a union free of slavery. And he expressed this conviction in a language of enduring clarity and beauty, exhibiting a literary genius to match his political genius. With his death, Abraham Lincoln had come to seem the embodiment of his own words, with malice toward none, with charity for all, voiced in his second inaugural, to lay out the visionary pathway to a reconstructed Union. The deathless name he sought from the start had grown far beyond Sangamon County and Illinois, reached across the truly United States, until his legacy, as Stanton had surmised at the moment of his death, belonged not only to America, but to the ages, to be revered and sung throughout all time. Epilogue. Against all odds, Seward and his son Frederick eventually recovered from their frightful injuries, but the night of horrors took its ultimate toll on Frances Seward. 6 weeks afterward, convinced that she had taken on the afflictions of her loved ones through vicarious suffering, she collapsed and died. Her funeral in Auburn was said to have brought together the largest assemblage that ever attended the funeral of a woman in America. In the months that followed, Fanny remained at her father's side, trying to compensate for her departed mother, until she herself fell desperately ill from tuberculosis. When she died, 2 months short of her 22nd birthday, Seward was inconsolable. "Truly, it may be said," the Washington Republican noted, "that the assassin's blows passed by the father and son and fell fatally on the mother and daughter." Seward remained Secretary of State throughout President Andrew Johnson's term. While his attempts to mediate Johnson's bitter struggles with the radicals in Congress failed, he took great pride in what was originally lampooned as Seward's folly, the purchase of Alaska. After retiring from public office, he spent his last years traveling. With Fred and Anna, he embarked on an 8-month journey to Alaska, California, and Mexico. Returning to Auburn, he immediately made plans for a trip around the world, visiting Japan, China, India, Egypt, Greece, Turkey, and France. He died peacefully in 1872, at the age of 71, surrounded by his family. When his daughter-in-law Jenny asked if he had any deathbed advice to impart, he said simply, "Love one another." Thurlow Weed, who served as a pallbearer, wept openly as the body of his oldest friend was lowered into the grave. Stanton's remaining days in the cabinet were acrimonious. His sympathy with the congressional radicals on Reconstruction brought him into open conflict with the president, who asked for his resignation. Refusing to honor Johnson's request, even after he was handed a removal order, Stanton barricaded himself in his office for weeks, taking his meals in the department and sleeping on his couch. He argued that his dismissal violated the Tenure of Office Act, recently passed by congressional radicals over the president's veto, which required Senate consent for the removal of any cabinet officer. Johnson's disregard for the Tenure of Office Act became one of the articles of impeachment lodged against him in 1868. When the impeachment failed by one vote in the Senate, Stanton finally submitted his resignation. Although exhausted by the ordeal, Stanton had little time to rest. His fortune had been depleted during his tenure in the cabinet. After returning to the practice of law, he was overjoyed when President Grant nominated him to the Supreme Court, the only office he had ever desired to hold, in December 1869. His happiness was short-lived. 3 days later, as his family gathered for the Christmas holidays, he suffered a severe asthma attack, lapsed into unconsciousness, and died. He had just turned 55. "I know that it is useless to say anything," Robert Todd Lincoln wrote to Stanton's son, Edwin Jr., "and yet, when I recall the kindness of your father to me, when my father was lying dead, and I felt utterly desperate, hardly able to realize the truth, I am as little able to keep my eyes from filling with tears as he was then." Edward Bates spent his remaining years with his close-knit family, reunited with his son Fleming, whom he had welcomed home from the Confederate Army once the war ended. When Bates died in 1869, at the age of 76, he was revered as much for his character as for his public accomplishments. Above all, one eulogist noted, it was in his social and domestic relations that his character shone brightest. It was as a husband, as a father, and a friend that he has endeared himself to others, by ties which death cannot sever. After presiding over the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson, Salmon Chase turned his addicted gaze to the 1868 presidential race, his hopes resting with the Democrats after Grant had secured the Republican nomination. With Kate serving as his campaign manager, he had his name placed before the delegates. But when Ohio announced for New York's Horace Seymour, Chase's candidacy was doomed. Once more, his home state had derailed his ambitions. 4 years later, still hoping for the presidential nod, he switched his allegiance to the Liberal Republican Party. Again, the nomination eluded him, going instead to Horace Greeley. His physical condition weakened by a heart attack and a stroke, Chase fell into depression, confiding to a friend that he was too much of an invalid to be more than a cipher. "Sometimes I feel as if I were dead." Death came on May 7, 1873, with Kate and Nettie by his side. He was 65. After her father's death, Kate saw her marriage to Sprague fall apart. An affair with New York Senator Roscoe Conkling ended in scandal when Sprague, finding the couple together at his Narragansett mansion, went after Conkling with a shotgun. Following a violent argument, during which Sprague tried to throw Kate from a bedroom window, she sued for divorce. She returned to Washington, where she died in poverty at 58. The Blairs returned to the Democratic Party. Though Frank Blair was selected as Seymour's vice presidential candidate in 1868, his intemperate denunciations of opponents cut short what might have been a promising political future. He died from a fall in his house in 1875, at the age of 54. Old man Blair outlived his son by 1 year, maintaining his physical vigor, his mental faculties, and his sprightliness of disposition until his death at 85. Montgomery served as counsel to Democrat Samuel Tilden in the disputed election of 1876, which Republican Rutherford B. Hayes eventually won. Blair was writing a biography of Andrew Jackson when he died in 1883 at the age of 70. Gideon Welles supported Andrew Johnson during the impeachment trial, remaining in the cabinet until 1868. Returning to Connecticut, he wrote a series of historical essays and was among the first to depict Lincoln as a towering figure coping admirably with Herculean tasks. His perceptive diary, which he edited in his last years, remains one of the most valuable sources on the dynamics within the Lincoln administration. Welles was 75 when he died from a streptococcus infection in 1878. John Nicolay and John Hay remained friends until the end of their lives, co-authoring a massive 10-volume study of Lincoln based on his then-unpublished papers. Nicolay was at work on an abridged version of their study when he died in 1901 at 69. Hay served as Secretary of State under Presidents William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt. Shortly before he died from a blood clot at the age of 66 in 1905, he dreamed that he had returned to the White House to report to the President, who turned out to be Mr. Lincoln. He was very kind and considerate and sympathetic about my illness. He gave me two unimportant letters to answer. I was pleased that this slight order was within my power to obey. 40 years after the assassination of his beloved chief, Hay awoke with an overpowering melancholy. Mary Lincoln never recovered from her husband's death. After returning to Illinois, she confided to Elizabeth Blair Lee that each morning, on awakening from my troubled slumbers, the utter impossibility of living another day so wretched appears to me as an impossibility. Were it not for her precious Ted, she told her boy's tutor, she would gladly welcome death. Mother and son were nearly inseparable. Ted journeyed with Mary to Europe, demonstrating what John Hay described as a thoughtful devotion and tenderness beyond his years. Not long after returning to America, Tad suffered what doctors termed compression of the heart. He died 2 months later, at 18. The modest and cordial young fellow who passed through New York a few weeks ago with his mother will never be known outside the circle of his mourning friends, commented John Hay in a touching obituary written for the New York Tribune. But little Tad will be remembered as long as any live who bore a personal share in the great movements whose center for 4 years was Washington. He was so full of life and vigor, so bubbling over with health and high spirits, that he kept the house alive with his pranks and his fantastic enterprises. Mary's misery was compounded by her ever-consuming worries over money. It is very hard to deal with one who is sane on all subjects but one, Robert confided in Mary Harlan, the young woman who would become his wife. You could hardly believe it possible, but my mother protests to me that she is in actual want, and nothing I can do or say will convince her to the contrary. Her increasingly erratic behavior persuaded Robert to commit her to a state hospital for the insane, where she remained for 4 months, until she was released to the care of her sister, Elizabeth, in Springfield. The episode permanently estranged Mary from her only remaining child. After a final trip to Europe, she lived her remaining years as a virtual recluse in the Edwards mansion, where, in happier days, she and Abraham Lincoln had met and married. She was 63 in 1882, when her oft-stated longing for death was fulfilled at last.
The End. You've been listening to Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, narrated by Suzanne Torin and directed by T.G. Reynolds and Tiana Kennedy. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.